This session of the 2013 Adelaide Festival of Ideas was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
Welcome to the Adelaide Festival of Ideas, to the Mock Ecclesiastic Bonython Hall, where the subject will be matters arising from George Pell, and my guest is David Marr. David bears a heavy burden because he's my favourite Australian journalist, as I frequently tweet. David is an extraordinary writer. He also is absurdly courageous, and he, rather than retreating from fights, he likes to start them. For me, prior to his quarterly essays, David's triumph was the book with Marion Wilkinson, Dark Victory, on the Howard election win based on a beaten-up refugee crisis, a book and an issue, of course, which continues to resonate. As he's not simply, he doesn't write quarterly essays, he writes drawn and quarterly essays. From which no victim escapes. And in the past, of course, he's focused on pretty ordinary earthbound creatures like Kevin Rudd and Tony Abbott. But on this occasion, he lifted his eyes to the heavens and has taken on a prince of the church. The issue, of course, is child abuse, but the ramifications of the Pell era extend far beyond that, as I hope we shall tease out in what happens now. David, it seems to me fair, given that we're going to be looking at the theologies and perhaps pathologies of George Pell and his religious beliefs, to ask about yours. You recently wrote very movingly about the death of your parents, so I'm not entirely invading privacy.
My mother's and my father's families were both Presbyterian, but my mother and my father had both been to Anglican schools, which had begun a sort of a slow drift into Anglicanism, and I was confirmed as an Anglican when I was 12 or 13. I went to an Anglican school in Sydney, and at about the age of 14, I went to one of those Anglican summer camps, and committed my life to Christ. I had an intense period of 4 or 5 years of religiosity. I was intensely devout, and I read a great deal of history and theology. It was the time, God bless us, of a book called Honest to God the Bishop of Southwark, Robinson. Somebody the other day said it's the 50th anniversary of the publication of that book. But I lost my faith at university. The fault was the philosophy department. One day, without any warning whatever, we were asked to sit and write a brief essay in light of present world conditions to try to square the propositions that God was both all-powerful and all-good. And I couldn't do it. I just could not do it. And that was the start of the end. Later, when I acknowledged my sexuality, that was the end of the end.
The sexual abuse of young children by parish priests employed to take them into their pastoral care. You will recall it was the unwillingness of members of the Victorian police to continue to stand back that unleashed the ticking bomb, followed soon after by New South Wales police. The Victorian police linked 40 suicides in the state to abuse by half a dozen priests and brothers alone. Now, very shortly, the report of the Victorian Parliamentary Inquiry into the handling of child abuse by religious and other organisations is due to be tabled, and following that, the Royal Commission created by former Prime Minister Gillard will continue its work. Now, drawn and quarterly essay, The Prince, Faith, Abuse and George Pell, has been walking off its shelves in stores, but the cardinal himself has been strangely unresponsive. It's almost as though you're having a one-sided controversy.
The cardinal has responded briefly with a statement in which he said that my problem was that I had no idea what it was to be a believing Christian. I'm not sure how that answers any of the problems that are raised in my essay. He also deliciously lives in an intellectual firmament where he still believes that G.K. Chesterton can deliver the knockout blow. And he quotes Chesterton saying that the hero, that a good novel is the portrait of its hero, a poor novel is the portrait of its author. There are a couple of problems with that, of course, which is that this is not a novel. And the other is that my understanding of my studies of English literature is that both good and bad novels are very good portraits of their authors. He also said that it was regurgitated and familiar and predictable stuff. So he has, in fact, responded. But his followers and his defenders have been essentially absolutely silenced.
Gerard Henderson.
Well, Gerard Henderson is in an interesting position. Gerard Henderson is a Sydney commentator who is an alumnus of BA Santa Maria. Now, I found myself, having dealt with BA Santa Maria's influence in my Tony Abbott essay, back in the world of BA Santa Maria with the Pell essay. I hadn't really realised that Pell is another one of those people whose whole lives have been shaped by an adolescent confrontation with B.A. Santa Maria. And as with Tony Abbott, George Pell in Ballarat in the middle of the 1950s, just before the split, at the height of the Cold War, went to a meeting that B.A. Santa Maria was addressing and was swept away by the heroic mission that Santa Maria was offering to young men of faith, to save civilization by being warriors for the faith inside society, and for some of them, to commit themselves to becoming priests. This was a completely formative experience. It's a very strange thing, of course, is that the political party that B.A. Santa Maria formed, the DLP, collapsed and burnt in the middle of the 1970s out of sort of sheer irrelevance and nastiness. And many people thought, well, that's it, that's over. But in fact, the influence of this dynamically interesting figure in our recent history is still very much with us, partly through commentary, because people like Gerard Henderson and Greg Sheridan in the Australian. There are still Santa Mariaites who are at the very heights of public commentary, and we have deliciously, unexpectedly, at this late time, a situation where our Prime Minister is a Santa Mariaite and the head of the Catholic Church is a Santa Mariaite, all at the one time. It's a heavenly constellation of stars, and is going to have a very interesting impact on our political life. But Gerard Henderson is the only one of the... He's more an attacker of me than a defender of Pell, frankly, to be fair to him. He's the only one who's spoken. Everybody else has been absolutely quiet. It would seem that the verdict has been that it is better not to make matters worse for Pell by attempting to defend him.
It's interesting, isn't it, that suddenly religion is centre stage again in Australian politics in a way it hasn't been for quite a while.
Well, I've been writing about religion and politics for 20 or so years, and what I always urge people to understand is that it is a subtle interplay of what is desired by the religious and what is possible in a society like ours. And the fact that the Prime Minister and the Cardinal are close to one another, at times the Prime Minister has called the Cardinal his spiritual advisor, does not mean that Tony Abbott is this man's puppet. It does not indeed dictate the political agenda of somebody like Abbott.
Well, Abbott, to his credit, didn't back Pell's opposition to the Gillard Royal Commission.
That's right. One of the themes of my essay, and perhaps it's what makes me angriest, almost angriest of all, about the response of the Catholic Church to the child abuse crisis as it evolved, is that the Church has never shown any curiosity to know how bad things have actually been in their own ranks. There has never been a systematic investigation of the extent of the problem by any Catholic diocese or any Catholic order. They have not wanted to know. The strategy has been to respond to complaints, to respond to the appeals of victims, and in some ways the response to victims has been very fine, in other ways very poor. But there has never been a wish to know exactly what's gone on. And what's more, Pell led opposition to any move that there be a secular inquiry into what has gone on, either in the Catholic Church or the other churches or indeed other institutions. And for over a decade, he was always on hand to beat back demands for royal commissions as they were being repeatedly made. They began in the early Howard years. Howard always backed Pell, always on this issue, always said, no, no, we won't have a royal commission. And even as terrible things like the findings of the inquiries in Ireland were being published, and come on, Ireland is Australia. We are provinces of one another's countries. The Irish Church and the Australian Church are indistinguishable. This was not a strange institute. This was not the church in Belgium. This was the church in Ireland. And the findings of those series of inquiries in Ireland were appalling, devastating. They have changed how the Irish worship. They have changed how the Irish behave. They were very dramatic, and they immediately provoked calls in Australia for a royal commission here. And Pell's reply was, "Australia is not Ireland. We don't need it." And in the week before Gillard announced her royal commission, in the days before, in fact, Pell gave an interview condemning the notion of a royal commission. He preached against a royal commission. He wrote one of his Sunday columns against the notion of a royal commission. And the following day, he had to welcome the Prime Minister's royal commission. But even in the face of all of that advocacy of his, even him trying to block it all, in the hours before Gillard announced the royal commission, Tony Abbott put out a very fine statement saying, so long as it's not just an inquiry into the Catholic Church, we will support it. So Abbott is not this man's puppet, though the interaction of the two is going to be interesting to watch.
He is his Minister for Science as well, though, isn't he?
Well, it is said unkindly of George Pell that nothing the Pope supports will be opposed by him. And while that's true kind of 98% of the time, he didn't agree with Pope John Paul II or with Pope Benedict on the issue of global warming. One of the missions of Pell's life is to deal with the warming alarmists. And he is of the view, it's not completely clear what he's, anyway, he certainly thinks that global warming alarm is rubbish. But then, to my mind, the fundamental problem here is a problem of science, is a problem of fact. The traditional Christian conception of sexuality is as wrong about human beings as the notion that the sun revolves around the earth. And what we're dealing with here, I hope, are the last ugly decades of a collision between the very ordinary facts of human life and an ethical conception of how we should behave sexually that is just not applicable, and in trying to apply it, simply infinitely cruel.
LNL, coming to you from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas. The venue is the Bonython Hall. My guest is David Marr, and we're talking about matters arising from Cardinal Pell. The great thing about Australian public life, which makes it possible for all sorts of people to survive all sorts of scandals, is that the media has the attention span of an earthworm. You know, we forget, we constantly forget and have to be reminded by works like yours. I lived through all the things you're describing, all the controversies, but I'd forgotten the details. And you bring them roaring back into public sight. If in fact it was a novel, let us look briefly at the central character of Cardinal Pell. Tell me about his background, his origins.
Well, this is not fiction. This is my attempt to understand what actually happened. Pell's father is a Protestant. His mother is a Catholic, and they came from Ballarat. And this is one of those stories where the town matters deeply in the character and the career of the central figure. Because Ballarat in the 50s was a community where Catholicism really worked. It really did its work. There were good schools for Catholic kids. The church was working to move kids out of poverty or out of, you know, a menial's existence into the professions, and was doing it well. And what's more, the loyalty of that community of Ballarat meant that kids might go away to Melbourne University to become doctors or lawyers or become accountants, but they came home again. So that Ballarat, the Catholic community of Ballarat, was strong, prosperous, confident, very Irish, very rule-bound, very conservative, and it was a town of great division between the Catholic Ballarat and the Protestant Ballarat was deeply divided, but everything about it suggested to a bright Catholic kid with real leadership potential growing up in that town that Catholicism worked. It really, really worked. He had his meeting with Santa Maria, dedicating his life to the notion of, you know, the heroic defence of Catholicism. And at the age of 18, he went into the seminary at Werribee. Do you remember that magnificent house, Werribee? You've seen pictures of it. And the Churnside Mansion. And at that time, the seminaries were bursting with people. Bursting! It was the high tide of Catholicism. And George Pell has been fated to spend his entire career in the church watching the tide go out. But he is a person who has, as Tom Keneally told me for the essay, Tom put it as he has a holding on mentality. He's not a person to leave. And Tom Keneally compared the kind of sticking with it mentality of a Pell to the sticking with it mentality of those old comms. And it didn't matter what the Communist Party did. They never left, you know. It didn't matter about Hungary. It didn't matter about the Velvet.
I was there. Well, yes.
Yeah. And Pell has survived as a rock inside this church, always hanging on. And I think it goes back to a childhood where, you know, he saw it work.
Is there a conflict between what one might describe as the muscularity of his Christianity and his sexual beliefs?
He is an absolute defender of clerical celibacy, an absolute defender of it. And when I come back to this issue of child abuse and how it has flourished in particular inside the Catholic Church, it seems to me that celibacy does not make men pedophiles. Most pedophiles are married men. Most child abuse occurs within families. But in terms of religious institutions, that authority on the Catholic Church, Professor Patrick Parkinson, from Sydney University, who, for many years, until he broke with them recently, advised the Catholic Church on its handling of child abuse problems. He says that the Catholic Church presents six times as many victims as all of the other churches combined. And I think the issue is that the defence of clerical celibacy meant that the church provided a safe haven for paedophiles, because the church knows that celibacy doesn't work. I mean, it doesn't work. With the work of Richard Sipe, in particular in the United States, a former monk and now a psychotherapist, I think, who has drawn on a number of surveys of what priests actually do, and his conclusion is that most priests have sex lives. And there was recently another study in Spain of the sex lives of priests, and in Spain the findings were something over 60% of priests had sex lives. So that celibacy and the enormous weight of prestige that is placed on celibacy by the church, it's not a fraud, it's not real. And therefore the church has had to do two things. It has had to forgive a great deal of sexual behaviour in its priests, and for a very long time that included sexual encounters with children. And at the same time, it had to pretend that everybody who is a priest and brother was celibate. And that was a perfect safe haven for paedophiles. And plus, of course, the church gave them endless access to children.
As a part of our collective amnesia, we have forgotten that Pell himself was subject to accusations.
When, shortly after Pell became Archbishop of Sydney, a Melbourne man emerged to lay a complaint that Pell had interfered with him when he was an altar boy and Pell was a seminarian in the early 1960s, one summer on Phillip Island. Pell stood aside as Archbishop of Sydney, and a retired judge, a splendid man called Alex Southwell, was hired by the church to examine the issue because the complainant did not wish to go to the police. It emerged instantly that the complainant, having put behind him the saintly life of a altar boy, had gone on to a significant life of crime. That was spread instantly. A number of conservative commentators in the press had all the details of that within hours. All of it was supposed to be secret. They had it within hours. The inquiry found that the complaint against Pell was not established. But the inquiry also found that the complainant had every appearance of speaking the truth. So it was not established, but it was not quite the complete exoneration that Pell has always claimed since it was. A devastating time for him as Archbishop of Sydney, and when it was all over, he returned to public life, and not long after was made a cardinal.
David, let's get to the big question of the oppression, suppression by the church of the mounting, ever-escalating charges. What was going on?
First, we have to understand that this is not something that began in 1971. This has been going on forever. What happened in the 1970s and 1980s is that two forces ceased to have such strength. One was absolute respect for the priesthood, and the other one was shame about coming forward to the police to say what had happened. It began, of course, the scandal began to unravel, of course, as these things do, first in America. And in the early 1980s in Louisiana, angry Catholic parents and angry Catholic lawyers sued a priest, Father Galter, in Louisiana. And in the end, that priest in that little corner of Louisiana would cause the church to make payouts of over $20 million. And that team of parents and lawyers were suing not just on behalf of the victims, but as they made clear at the time, they wanted to send a message to the American bishops that they were not running a clean house. And in Australia, in the late 1980s, the bishops got together a rather Orwellian committee called the Special Interests or something. I've forgotten for the moment.
The Spanish Inquisition?
No. Philip, you must understand there is no Inquisition. There is no investigation. None of that. And they got together a committee which was simply to work out how to defend the church's assets in case anybody sued in Australia. But how it unraveled in Australia, the shifts in public opinion, and the crucial, as you mentioned earlier, crucial shifts in the opinion of the police. As in Ireland, it is now clear that the police in Australia would pick up priests, would hear of errant priests, and they would leave them to the churches to deal with. And certainly in the 1970s and well into the 1980s, in both orders and dioceses in Australia, priests who had been raping children were withdrawn from service for a while. Perhaps they were made a chaplain in a hospital. Always interesting to look on the CV of a priest. Was he a chaplain in a hospital briefly? Was there a brief academic excursion to the United States to do a little postgrad degree? Was there a trip to, in the more serious cases, was there a trip to the Order of the Paraclete in New Mexico, which offered to cure pedophiles through prayer and religious exercises? And then they were brought back, and then they were put back into another parish. Now, don't believe for a moment that why they were being shifted around was unknown to the parishes where they arrived. Priests know everything. They are phenomenally efficient gossips. What else have they got to do with their time? That's a little cruel, David, and I withdraw it. But if somebody suddenly leaves a parish and the bishop says, you know, suddenly it's turning up in your parish, they get on the phone. They know exactly the reason, but they're not allowed, of course, to tell their parishioners. So priests were still being moved around very occasionally, from the late 1970s, there was the odd prosecution of a priest. But it was not really until the early 1990s in Australia that the police attitudes changed sufficiently for them to begin generally to take seriously complaints of pedophilia by priests and religious. And it was then, from the early 1990s onwards, that both the prosecutions and the attempts, fruitless attempts, to sue the church began.
And let's now factor in Pell's contribution to this crisis.
Well, just by chance, Pell became a bishop for the first time in 1987, which was just as the Australian church was beginning to get worried about the repercussions of all of this out here. And I can't tell you, you'll have to read the essay to find out, how appalling the bishop's first attempt to deal with it was in the protocol of 1992. Never admit a thing, no sympathy to the victims, absolutely stonewall the victims. Brutal, brutal. It was supposed to be a secret document. It was immediately leaked, again, by angry Catholics. This whole story is driven by angry, faithful Catholics. They leaked that document, and immediately the bishops went into a huddle. They got better people to try and come up with a better solution. Pell was the auxiliary bishop of Melbourne from 1987. He took no part in any of the drafting of the early protocols, but he was responsible in Melbourne for parishes which had a number of terrible priests. And in particular, he was responsible for the parish of Doveton, a working-class parish in Melbourne, which had Father Peter Searson, a man so loathed in his own parish and feared in the primary school of the parish that the teachers would do all they could never to allow a child to be alone in his presence. Children ran screaming from confessional. A lot of the time he carried a gun. He had a delusion. He had a delusion that he was a lieutenant colonel in the military. He used to wear a khaki kind of bib with his collar. He was visibly nuts. Nuts.
And Dave, don't hold back.
No. He was nuts. And a fine man called Graham Sleeman, who was the headmaster of this little school, said to the church, he has got to go. You've got to get this man out of here. If you don't, I will go. The church sided with the priest. Then, as auxiliary bishop, Pell received two delegations from parents and teachers telling him about Searson. We don't know how much he was told about Searson, but on both occasions he declined to take action, other than have a conversation with Searson, which he afterwards described as a really awful experience for him. Searson remained in that parish for a further 6 years until finally one of the parents went to the police after Searson had bashed their son for allegedly giggling during Mass. And it was the complaint to the police that was the end of Searson. And at that time, the Archdiocese of Melbourne was run by Archbishop Frank Little. At that time, it appeared that you had to actually have an active complaint to the police before the church would act to protect the children of the parishes. And that was while Pell was an auxiliary bishop of one section of the Archdiocese. He was blind to what was going on when he was a priest in Ballarat, and Ballarat was one of the worst places in Australia for a Catholic child to grow up. He admits this. He talks about himself being wet behind the ears. He talks about that kind of thing not being his responsibility. And he can't remember the incident when he was a young priest, when a boy, Tim Green, with amazing courage, said to him one day, "Father, you've got to do something about Brother Dowland at St. Patrick's. He's abusing the boys." Now, Pell has no memory of that conversation. Tim Green remembers Pell saying, "Don't be ridiculous," and leaving the room. Brother Dowland went on to abuse children for another 20 years until he was finally imprisoned. And he was not imprisoned until the Christian Brothers had spent many millions of dollars on his defence. So that was Pell. Pell as a priest admits he was blind. Pell as bishop did not remove Searson. On becoming archbishop, he moved extremely rapidly. And he has to be given credit for moving extremely rapidly to put in place what's known as the Melbourne response, which was a way of giving meagre compensation and quite generous pastoral care to the victims of paedophilia. It was just in Melbourne. The rest of Australia had and has a protocol called Towards Healing, but Pell moved quickly. One of the outcomes of Pell moving quickly, and both of Towards Healing and of the Melbourne response, is victims are paid very, very, very little compensation for what's happened to them.
Before I open this to questions from the audience, David, what were the riding instructions being issued to bishops and cardinals around the world by the Vatican?
You can't understand the situation in Australia unless you understand how the Vatican was responding, particularly to the wish, the deep wish of the American bishops, firstly, simply to be able to sack pedophile priests. Now, John Paul II had his weaknesses, and one of them was that he was really bad on this issue, really bad. He refused to deal with some very prominent Catholics who had been caught abusing children on a vast scale. And he refused to cede to the bishops the right to just simply sack the priests. That was a role for Rome. And until almost the very last years of John Paul II's reign, you couldn't defrock a priest unless the priest was willing to be defrocked. It was as bad as that. And there were orders for the greatest secrecy, in all dealings with pedophile priests and brothers. That was a crucial part of the orders from Rome as well. Benedict was much better than John Paul II on this issue. He had a much clearer understanding of the need for Rome to have proper tribunals and to deal with errant priests. Things became better under him, but nevertheless, it is still the case that you will be excommunicated for arguing, say, for women priests or married clergy. You will be excommunicated swiftly. You still really basically won't be excommunicated for raping children.
David Marr, Festival of Ideas, and this is an LNL coming to you from the Bonython Hall. I would now like to invite audience members to the one microphone we have, right smack back in the centre, and thank you. Sir.
Yeah, thanks, David. As someone outside the Catholic Church, one of the things I learnt from reading an article was how much Cardinal Pell's power depends on his links with Rome. The Catholics have a new pope now. Will this affect Pell's power, or is it the same old band that are going to continue with the same policies?
One of the fascinating things for me, after all of those studies of politicians that I've done all through my career, was to discover how very different power is in an organisation like the Catholic Church. I mean, I always knew that, but it was fascinating to get down into it. Because somebody, an archbishop, doesn't need anybody to like him. He's not answerable to a board of directors. He's not like an industrialist. He's not like a politician. He doesn't have to keep the local branch happy with his work. He doesn't have to keep the local party happy with his work. His power, obviously, all comes from Rome. And Pell's power was considerable because he was very much a young, high-flying bishop. At the time that he was not taking Searson off, you know, he's not, you know, dragging Searson out of Doveton, he was sitting on the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith in Rome, formulating new and horrific descriptions of homosexuals as, you know, objectively disordered, going to hell, etc. He was busy in Rome with some very important work. And that's in fact where he and Benedict became friends. They were working together on there. So his power comes from Rome, and he has been at times apparently on the brink of very high postings in Rome. They never quite come off. All his career, he has been dedicated to the notion of obedience to the Pope. His view of the Catholic Church is that it cannot operate if people are allowed to rely on their own consciences, which is very much the message of Vatican II, the Jesuit message. They have to obey the Pope. And that's why the rules of you know, sex rules are so important, is because they are about the machinery of the Church operating properly. So now we have a fascinating situation where the Pope is a Jesuit, and while not saying the sex rules will be changed, is saying they don't matter all that much. You know, they're not absolutely crucial. If you keep banging on about the sex rules, the Pope has said, then the whole house of cards is going to fall. I am, by the way, delighted by the notion of a Pope referring to the Catholic Church as a house of cards. So it will be interesting here to see whether how Pell balances a very different Pope with his absolute dedication to obedience to the Pope. But the last words of your question, sir, are the crucial ones. Will, in fact, it just keep on going as it always has? And this Pope seems to be determined to doing something about the spirit in which the bureaucracy of Rome operates. And that's the key to that question. But Pell, of course, is part of the 8-cardinal committee, which will be overseeing those reforms. So a lot of interest ahead on that.
While the next person goes to the microphone at the centre of the stage, and I'm handed an urgent memo. Thank you very much, Christine, one of my dominatrixes at Late Night Live. Madam.
Thank you. for your essay and for keeping this very important issue in the public light and for what it does to assist the people who suffered at the hands of the church. My question to you is, do you have any insight into what it was that finally turned the police around to act on this issue? Because that seems to have been the turning point when things really started to happen in the way that they should have happened if it had been any other institution.
A new generation of police with better education. And the professionalising of the police force, of getting the police to stay in school, to do post-school, get post-school qualifications, has transformed the police forces of Australia and has a very important impact on society in Australia. And that was part of it. And it was so a new kind of police. Also, a new kind of journalist, particularly working on country town newspapers. A lot of this story is about country town newspapers dealing with visible scandals in their towns. And that's partly the story of Ballarat. It's very much the story of Bathurst in New South Wales, where there are a series of scandals which we can't talk about at the moment because there are trials going on. A new kind of journalist, a new kind of police, and a dying out in the police force of an old system that operated, I'm not sure whether it operated here in South Australia as much as it did in New South Wales and in Victoria, where certain squads of the force were Catholic and other squads were Masonic or Protestant. And that kind of, as that kind of religious division died out in the general community, it died out in the police forces, and it produced a profound change. Now, when a complaint came, there came a point when a complaint came to the police that a child was being interfered with or groomed or even raped, the police took it absolutely seriously. And that was an important moment.
I'm glad that issue was raised while I wait someone else to go to the microphone. I grew up in literally within the shadow of Raheem, the great Mannix temple. And I'd go to school every morning with my best friend, Johnny Sinclair. We'd parted the gates. He went left to the Catholic school. I went to the state school. We would chant, "Catholic dogs stink like frogs jumping out of hollow logs." Their response was "state, state, full of hate," which was absolutely accurate. But, David, you're right to point to the fact that the Victorian police was riven by the same religious division.
So was New South Wales police. But, you know, growing up as a Protestant, one of the terrible things that we were taught when I was a kid is the problem with Catholics, we were told, is their loyalty. What are they loyal to? Are they loyal to the church or are they loyal to Australia? And you can't trust Catholics, I was always told, because, you know, their real loyalty is to Rome. And I fought that view in myself. I fought it to obliteration. And we were all helped in dealing with that view by the presidency of John F. Kennedy. That was a transformative moment in relations between Catholics and Protestants, even in this country. But you know, the story of this, the story of how the church handled the child abuse, is exactly the story that I was told by bigots when I was a child. It turns out to be true, or it turned out to be true. The church in Australia did everything it could in order not to let those who had committed these serious crimes be dealt with by the police and by the courts, and to be dealt with instead by their own most forgiving machinery.
Sir.
forgive me, I'm experiencing a senior's moment in that I can't remember the name of the former Governor-General who was an Archbishop.
Peter Hollingworth.
Thank you. And I can't help drawing parallels between the two. The same arrogance, the same ability to deal with the media. Do you feel that Pell is destined for the same demise?
No. I have no idea how Pell's career will turn out. And I reflect on those two men that, as Hollingworth was facing terribly widespread public criticism because of his mishandling of paedophilia allegations, Pell was one of those people who publicly called on him to resign as Governor General.
I'd forgotten that.
Yep, he did. Wow. He called on Hollingworth to resign. In the aftermath of the Hollingworth crash, his successor in Brisbane, Philip Aspinall, Anglican Archbishop of Brisbane, called for what the Catholic Church has never done, which was an inquiry into how bad things were in the Anglican Church in Queensland. And he begged for state help to conduct that inquiry because he knew that a church tribunal would not have the power to compel witnesses to answer questions, would not have the power to compel documents to be produced. And both Peter Beattie and John Howard declined to set up, to assist him, to set up a proper commission of inquiry into the problems within the Anglican Church. That was a contrast. So there is both comparison there and there's contrast.
Another question from the floor, please. Thank you.
David, can I ask you to elaborate on what and where in the essay you comment about Cardinal Pell's position in the Australian Church? On the one hand, you've mentioned once or twice that he's never been elected president of the Bishops' Conference of Australia, and you imply that that was a conscious decision, that he didn't have the support of his fellow bishops. And on the one hand, Cardinal Pell tries to represent himself as Primate of Australia, while never adopting the term. And on the other hand, at other occasions, he says, I'm only Archbishop of Sydney, and hence not responsible for anything else.
It's clear to all of you, isn't it, that the Catholic Church doesn't exist? Is that absolutely clear to you? It's very, very important that you understand that it doesn't exist. Yes, it has buildings and schools and hospitals, and it's indeed the largest non-government employer in Australia, and it has property holdings of untold billions of dollars, but it doesn't exist. In law, it's a voluntary organisation. If any of you are members, say, of a Monday night book club, something like that, meet occasionally and discuss books, you've got exactly the same corporate structure as the Catholic Church, and therefore you are unsuable as an organisation. And nobody is a leader, and nobody has authority over anybody else, and that's the situation of the Church in Australia. It's a vast archipelago of absolutely independent fragments that has no corporate structure, and therefore George Pell is at some time simply the Archbishop of Sydney, which is actually a remarkably small and not particularly rich diocese compared to Melbourne, but he had to leave Melbourne to go to Sydney to become a cardinal. And at times he is clearly the voice of the Church in Australia, and we, the press, have always dealt with him as the most forceful and the bravest sort of commentator, and we have made him a leader in that way. But he chooses which identity suits him at the time, and when the church is under attack in this way for its failure, or is being called to account rather than under attack, when it is being called to account for its failures to deal with this scandal, he suddenly has no power whatever. But he has never represented mainstream Australian Catholicism. He represents, of course, an important party within Australian Catholicism, the extremely conservative wing of the Church. He has only ever had the support of a handful of bishops among the bishops, and the decision not to elect him president of the Australian Bishops' Conference is absolutely deliberate, marked, and emphasised by all of those senior Catholics who deplore the kinds of policies and the kind of faith that he has, while still respecting him a good deal as the figure that he is.
I must say there's another similarity, therefore, between he and Hollingworth, who wanted to be the big cheese in the Anglicans, but in the election he got one vote, which was believed to be his own. Another question from the floor, please. Thank you.
David, why do you think that the church persists with the idea of celibacy? Does it give some sort of spiritual advantage to them as opposed to us?
There is an argument that it's supposed to be about making sure that priests don't get away with church property. I think that I don't understand that argument. What is always clear about us, our species, is that we advertise our virtue by indicating that we can give up things, that we have self-control, that we can give up meat on Friday was a significant act of virtue. For Jews, that you never eat shellfish or pork. These are dietary rules, but they're also acts of virtue. To give up possessions, a great act of virtue. And we recognize that as an act of virtue. To give up sex is the greatest imaginable act of virtue for a human being, if you look at it through that prism. And therefore it brings profound spiritual authority to the person who does it and the institution that demands it happen. On the other hand, it's just, you could say that this is a ridiculous negation of an ordinary way to live, demonizes human sexuality, puts the people who attempt celibacy through torture, and produces perverse forms of human behavior. It depends how you look at it, you know, which scrim that you look at it through, while acknowledging at all times that celibacy is for some priests perfectly natural and livable. And if they wish to be celibate, that's fine. But as a rule, as an imposed rule, and why it has been defended so solidly, it's about spiritual prestige.
I think it's wonderful that you've said this in this audience, because I have a sense that everyone here will leave this building and have a life of celibacy. Another question, please, from someone hopefully celibate.
Hi. How do you see the future for the Catholic Church here in Australia?
We too easily, simply by counting attendance at Mass, conclude that the Church is a failing institution. And it certainly, you know, in terms of attendance, if it was the Hoyts cinema chain, you'd be worried. But the reality is, and Pell has a good deal to do with this reality, because he has been an astonishingly effective lobbyist on behalf of his church. The fact is that the church in institutional terms has never been as remotely strong as it is today. Enormous sums of money, government money, now flow through the church in order that it fulfil the welfare obligations that it's willingly taken up. And as far as I know, it fulfills those welfare obligations pretty damn well. It's never educated so many children. It has never treated so many sick people. And it deals with welfare and charity on a broad front. Institutionally, it's strong. I mean, imagine in the late 20th century, partly because of George Pell's lobbying, the church set up in Australia with public money its own university system. Now, that is not a failing institution that can do something of that kind. So the future of the church is very strong. The need of many of us to have a faith and to worship is a very, very strong human need, and that's not going to go away. The question is whether or not the organisation is going to be able to become fully transparent and accountable for these terrible failings in the protection of children. And if it can be, then I've no reason to see the future of that faith as anything but very, very strong.
The next question comes from someone I met this morning and who I can identify as one of perhaps three Marxists in South Australia.
Thanks, Philip. What I'm interested in, David, is your portrait of very valuable insight into B.A. Santa Maria as a pivotal, influential figure on Tony Abbott and on George Pell. And what I'm interested in is, do you see any... I'm interested in the influence, the international influences, perhaps on Santa Maria, of perhaps Francoist fascism and the work of Opus Dei. I'm just interested if you see any connections there and therefore any inheritance into our, the two current figures you're talking about.
I don't know enough about B.A. Santa Maria to actually make a useful comparison of that kind. But certainly it's true that Santa Maria and Pell both argue about moral necessity in politics in a way that they see as a countervailing force to simply popular opinion. And moral leadership, vigorous moral leadership, was certainly one of the great appeals of fascism. But I'm not saying for a moment that Pell's a fascist. I'm not saying that B.A. Santa Maria was. But what the point about the Santa Maria influence is, there's a tactical point, which is they fight nasty, they fight ad hominem, they attack people, but they have exaggerated notions of evil lingering behind really ordinary aspects of modern life. I mean, there was a time when Santa Maria simply raged about the evil of television, and his followers raged about the evil of television, and yet he was a great exponent of television. And of course, the pill raging about you know, sexual immorality, raging about homosexuality, raging about all of these evils. And when communism was contained, when the Berlin Wall fell, they moved seamlessly into raging about, you know, the ordinary beliefs of the left. And now they rage, as Pell rages, about secularism. There's this thing called secularism. And the reason Pell says that we must never have a Bill of Rights in Australia is that it will allow profound issues to be settled according to the secular agenda. Now, this is a world that I have very little sympathy with. I'm very interested in trying to work it all out, but it's certainly not, in any straightforward way, a democratic world.
A final question, thank you.
David, do you think it's time that the Catholic Church, as well as other religious institutions in Australia, became legal entities subject to the law and paid taxes?
Of course. I mean, you cannot understand this story unless you understand that the Catholic Church in Australia, partly because, as I was explaining before, that it doesn't exist, but partly because it quarantines all of its property in trusts, which have nothing to do with the hiring and the supervision of priests. So the law in Australia has, so far at least, always said that you can't go to the trusts for compensation for what a priest did to you. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And because the church defends itself ferociously, its lawyers are ferocious. And as far as we know, there has been no court award of damages to any victim of child abuse by a priest, because what happens is that there is an impenetrable wall surrounding the church and its assets, and you either settle with the church after paying your lawyers roughly twice what you would pay them if you were suing the Anglican Church. The Anglican Church is perfectly suable. Or you go to Towards Healing or the Melbourne Response and you take money which they don't even call compensation, and the lawyers involved in that tell me that victims who go through that process are paid 10 cents in the dollar of what they would be paid if they had been abused by an Anglican priest in a suable institution. I do not believe that at the end of this Royal Commission, God knows how far off that's going to be, I do not believe that astonishing privilege of having your assets untouchable will continue. I just don't believe it can survive. It's not the case in America. It's not the case in Britain. It's not the case in Canada. It is the case in Australia. I just don't believe that can endure.
The highest award that Late Night Live can bestow upon a guest is the koala stamp. I hereby give you a koala stamp, David. Thank you very much for your... Philip.
This session of the 2013 Adelaide Festival of Ideas was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.